Hey everyone, Paul here. Over the next 2 weeks, we're going to be talking about artificial intelligence. It's a subject that I confess to you, I am woefully incompetent on, but I am curious about. And so I brought in my friend Sam Tiedemann, who's a Harvard-trained data scientist in the field of biostatistics. So Sam has much more competency in the inner workings and understandings of how AI actually functions. And so these next 2 weeks are going to be conversation that I had with Sam, and it is mind-blowing, incredibly fascinating. I split it up into two parts because we talked for probably about maybe close to 2 hours. I have to go back and look at the timestamps there. But we had a very, very long conversation about this. And if you want to listen to all of it in its unedited form, that's available to those who are supporting on Patreon, patrons of this podcast. Can access the video of this conversation, the full-length, unedited conversation. You can go and watch that or listen to it right now on my Patreon page. You can find a link in the description. And by supporting, you help keep this podcast ad-free, so I don't have to throw in ads in the middle of this podcast for things that you probably don't need or maybe already have already. So if you support on Patreon, you can get access to the full, unedited conversation right away, and you can help keep the lights on for me. If not, you can wait till next week where part two of this long-form conversation will be out. And with that important business covered, here is part one of Can We Teach AI to Be Christian? Enjoy.
That situation is actually pretty ideal for AI because you give it a bunch of historical data. Did this person go on to get diagnosed with breast cancer? Yes or no? It's very easy to classify that. And it's a very morally unambiguous task. Make the right decision of whether this mammogram has breast cancer or not. There's very little moral complexity to that question. So it's a very good one for AI. And, you know, looking at all the different pixels and stuff like that through AI vision, that it's actually that one, you know, is an example of something I'm like, great. So we can have higher accuracy for cheaper, faster on mammograms and other sorts of, you know, scans that you can turn into a digitized picture, feed the pixels through an AI machine. And it's been trained on a whole bunch of these pictures to say, this one goes on to have cancer, this one doesn't, you know, like, great. Okay. That one, no problem with, because it's a relatively constrained and focused problem. And AI needs very constrained and focused problems that are not morally ambiguous. So you're saying, could we try and input like a Christian morality, such as what nurses are being formed with at Bethel, into an AI? But the challenge is like, well, Paul, could you write all of that in if-then statements for me? Could you write a list of 10,000 if-then statements that fully encapsulate this idea of moral, of a Christian moral framework?
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Deep Talks. I'm sure maybe this will also be shared on Sam's channel as well. So many of you who've been longtime listeners know that I've had some really good conversations with Sam in the past. Sam Tiedemann and his channel, The Transfigured Channel. You're still posting under the Transfigured Channel name, Sam?
Yes. Yes, okay. I am. Yeah.
And we've had some great conversations in the past on my channel and his channel. And Sam was recently on with our mutual friend, John Vervaeke. And they were talking about AI and ethics, AI and
morality.
I don't know how else you would describe it.
Yeah, the morality of AI. Yeah. And can AI be moral? And can AI have a sense of value or a sense of purpose and that sort of question?
Yeah, and I've not really done, as I look back on it, I've not done really any conversations on my channel, on my podcast surrounding AI. And we probably won't stay there, but there was a moment in your conversation with John that I wanted to pick your brain on a little bit more because, well, let me backtrack a little bit. So even just last night, I had a 25-minute conversation with ChatGPT's new voice integration on my phone. And installed that. I was like, I want to play with that a little bit. You know, Siri doesn't do a really good job of really like doing half of what like ChatGPT can do in,
right,
in like answering your questions. And so I had found myself in a 25-minute conversation with my AI voice on my phone about the differences between Bronze Age and Axial Age religions. And I found it actually really fun, strangely enough, but also it did feel oddly dystopian too.
Yeah.
At the same time. And so that got me thinking a little bit about what you and John were talking about, because you and your like day job have been working in the medical field, right? That's probably the best umbrella.
Yeah. I don't currently work in healthcare, but most of my career has been in healthcare technology.
Yeah. Okay. And so when you and John were talking about the process of trying to evaluate, could an AI make moral, ethical, beyond utilitarian judgments about who should be seen first waiting in the emergency room? That really caught my attention, because I was just a few weeks ago in the ER with one of my kids, and we were waiting there for 4 hours. And understandably, like, I wasn't, you know, upset about the wait. I mean, you obviously you're in the ER, so you'd like to get in sooner, but I understand the constraints. I saw someone that probably does like the nurse staffing come out, and one of the nurses who was at the front desk and doing kind of like the initial assessments of patients coming in, she was like, I got to have more help here. And she's like, we're just maxed out. We can't do anything about it. And I started noticing, and it's always been like this, and I've not my first time in the ER, but I think I had enough time to realize, oh, this isn't like a first come, first serve operation. You know, this isn't the deli where you take a number.
This isn't Chick-fil-A.
Yeah. It's not Chick-fil-A where you just, you know, whoever made it to the drive-through first gets in. And I started to notice, and I was even wrestling with this, because I was noticing that there were clearly some identifiable markers that were, to me, identifiable markers of single moms coming in with kids that probably had the flu or maybe COVID. And then families coming in with younger children that, to my vantage point, based on the way they were dressed, seemed to be financially more economically stable, but possibly their child coming in with worse symptoms. And so I noticed in a particular instance where a family had come in a little more well-to-do and had a child that clearly looked like they had worse symptoms than some of the other kids that looked like they were coming from lower income, single parent backgrounds. And the family that was a little bit more well-to-do, but kid potentially exhibiting worse symptoms, hard for me to make that evaluation, was seen within probably 30 minutes, where I noticed there were clearly single mothers there in distress with their kids who had been waiting for as long as we had been waiting. And that got me thinking about, well, what sort of moral matrix here is being consulted? And then if we turn that over, and maybe you're saying it's already in some sense turned over to machines and AI, how in the world would we ever put in the proper inputs to make AI come up with, and even humans come up with, the proper moral evaluations in that situation to figure out who is a more life or death situation here? Who do we evaluate first? How much time and money do we sink into a patient? So maybe you could talk a little bit about that day job work of yours, Sam, if you don't mind, and
sure,
particularly the AI connections to evaluating who should be seen first in an emergency room.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I should say off the bat, like, most of my career, like I mentioned, is in healthcare technology, but an especially large of that has been focused on emergency departments. And so I've spent a fair amount of time in emergency departments, helping them with software stuff or building predictive models and things like that for use in emergency room settings. And I think, imagine we had like a panel of moral ethical philosophers at a hospital, and there was like, you know, a round table of like seven highly trained philosophers in ethics, it would still be a hard problem for them to all agree on what the right triage order should be for the patients in the waiting room versus the patients that are already being treated at the present moment. So it's not like it's obvious what the right answer should be, even from like, you know, the most enlightened human perspective that we could imagine. Mm-hmm. And like, how do you trade off like health urgency versus economic status and things like that? Like emergency rooms have so many problems in the United States, and this isn't actually uniquely American. Emergency departments all over the world deal with these issues in some form or another, but I'm mostly just familiar with the American setting. But a lot of people will, the emergency department is also a place of a lot of sort of financial and medical abuse by patients, where they will go there. Maybe they don't have insurance, or maybe they lie about not, they give the wrong insurance information so that they don't actually have to pay. And they know the emergency department's required to see them. And especially during the opioid epidemic, it was often a place where patients would go to try and just do whatever they could to get the right prescription from a doctor for opioids and stuff like that. And so emergency departments have sort of a built up resistance to that sort of behavior. And I think that that can sometimes result in discrimination and unfair judgments as well, because there's some jaded people who are like, oh, you're just here for drugs, or you're not going to pay your bill, or you're going to give me fraudulent insurance information, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's even in our most perfect imagining of what an emergency room is, where everyone is there for the right reasons and all the doctors and nurses are fabulous people, it's still tricky. But when you add in the messiness of the American healthcare system and all of those sorts of things, it's an especially messy and complicated place. So when you're saying people that appeared to have socially higher economic status were seen before the opposite, I'm not going to make any particular judgments. I don't even know what hospital you're talking about, but it's also possible that they could be knowing in some sense which patients are more likely to be able to pay their bill or not. And that is either consciously or subconsciously influencing their decision. And so
before that gets dismissed as a bias, I mean, if the bills perpetually don't get paid, you don't have a functioning hospital.
Emergency department, yeah.
And so then nobody's getting the proper care and treatment because they can't staff, right? So this isn't easy, as you're saying, for the highest moral philosophers and ethicists that you could gather in a room. This is not an easy decision moral matrix that you could come up with.
Right. And so what normally happens is that when you go to like the registration person and they ask you, why are you here? It's actually often that registration person who interestingly does not normally have any medical training. Maybe they were a nurse, but oftentimes they might not have any medical background whatsoever. They're often the ones making the decision of, they'll give you a number of 1 through 5. Most emergency departments use this 1 through 5 system of like basically least urgent to most urgent. Like if you rolled up with like a gunshot wound and you were bleeding out, you're going to get seen right away, basically. Right. So long as like they aren't filled with other gunshot wound victims. But that can happen too sometimes. Yeah. And so that person, that registration person, will give you a number, basically 1 through 5, of how urgent your situation is. And then you sort of get stacked in their software system based off of that. But even then, like, it might be a new room opens up and they only have people in like, say, the lowest first or second bucket. And they've got like 5 people to choose from in the second bucket. The registration person is actually often making that decision of who to call next. Or maybe there is a department manager that you don't see sort of behind the scenes making that judgment. And that person would be much more trained than just a front desk person. But that number of 1 through 5 often gets assigned to you with very little, medical input. So it's a very weird and complicated system. But like to anyway, with that sort of background out of the way, like imagine you were trying to use an AI to do this. And I've actually heard of projects specifically aimed at this problem. Like I think what you would do is you would build a predictive model and you would have the outcome variable, the target variable in your data set be like, of all the patients that I've seen, say, in the last year or two, did they, you know, have some severe bad outcome? Like, say, did they die or get admitted to the hospital for over a week or require severe intervention? And we'll just say that's one. And if you didn't have any of those things, you're a zero. And then you have a whole bunch of variables that you collect at that registration process, and you try and predict one or zero. And then you would get a probability for every patient between like 0% they'll be a one and 100% that they'll be a one. And you divide that up into five buckets or something like that. And then when you register someone, you send those variables from their registration process through this model. And then it gives you a 1 through 5 of how severe you are. But even then, that's not exactly answering the question that we really most care about. That's like, you know, judging what, quintile of risk of severe outcome you are. That's not quite the same as who should be seen first. And I think that what a problem that I often have seen over and over in these healthcare settings when I'm trying to build predictive models is like, so what are we actually trying to achieve? And how would we know if we're doing it better or not?
Yes.
And oftentimes we substitute that difficult question for a simple question. And the simple question might be somewhat parallel to the difficult question, but sometimes like, do we even know if that's like the right question to be asking? Should we just sort people by their probability of having a severe bad outcome? And that is how we decide, you know, who gets in and not. So I think that it's, and another weird thing that I've seen happen over and over in these sorts of projects and these sorts of settings is that humans often have this intrinsic idea that if we outsource it to a machine, it'll be less biased and more fair because humans can be unfair, but a machine wouldn't be unfair. And that's not necessarily the case at all. And, you know, a human can deal with all of these sorts of moral complexities. Like when that human registration person is like looking at what types of clothes the patients are wearing and how many other kids this single mom might have with them, like that, you aren't feeding those variables into your predictive model. So there are so many things that a human can pick up on that a machine can't, at least at this point in time. And I just get really frustrated on these sorts of projects when there is a lack of clear purpose and intention to the project, and we sort of simplify it into a variable that we have access to as opposed to the one that we would really want. And then we say that it's better because machines are just inherently more fair. And I don't think that that's actually true.
Well, I think there's an assumed like narrative structure and value structure there that is we might be blind to. And so let's take a hypothetical here. We'll get kind of nerdy here, and we'll picture an emergency room on a for all my Star Trek friends out there. Are you a Star Trek fan at all, Sam?
Not particularly.
Not really. No. Okay, so I don't know. Maybe you know what, at least generally who the Klingons are in Star Trek.
Yeah.
Very Spartan like. Maybe we'll make it more real world and say Sparta, but they didn't have probably emergency rooms in ancient Sparta. But picture,
but they're more emotional, aggressive, belligerent.
Yes. Right? And you might say like social Darwinist as well, where the weakness is a weakness. The weakness of the individual is a weakness to the collective. And so what we want to actually do is invest more time, energy, and resources into those who are strong. So you could picture a scenario here where you are in an emergency room on a Klingon bird of prey, and the matrix, the moral matrix that they are evaluating is filtered through their guiding story. And their guiding story is a narrative of strength, power, combat, right? And so you go in and you see poor, maybe weak or, you know, kind of just generally sickly looking child up against a kid that just got, you know, hurt in sparring, you know, And you think, well, there's a strong child. So as they consult their guiding story, which informs that moral matrix, they would evaluate and say, hey, we, of course, we're going to see this the child, the Klingon child that might be more likely to be a warrior, right? In our moral matrix, and I was aware of this at the time, I was evaluating my own felt sense of there are some people here in the room that if I am the decision maker, I am likely going and saying, I'm going to get you care first. Mm-hmm. And that moral matrix is informed by my guiding story of the Christian story.
Right.
You know, so I am aware
where we should pay attention to the weak and the vulnerable
the
and the needy,
these, right?
That single mom who's got two other kids crawling on her and one sick kid. Yeah.
Yeah. But if I'm a Klingon, I'm probably not. If I am in Nazi Germany, I'm probably not. If I'm in
a field hospital during a battle, right?
Right.
You're trying to prioritize the soldiers that you can fix to get fighting again. To give them care as opposed to prevent saving lives or something like that.
Yeah. And so my thing that I don't have any of area of expertise in, but I think you probably at least have more than I, would be if you were to come up with some sort of and you know, a ChatGPT or, you know, some AI that would kind of try to remove the biases and to give effective care to those most deserving of immediate effective care, you would have to assume that the humans building those programs are importing some sort of guiding story.
Yeah.
The overarching story and moral matrix of their culture that they are trying to train the machine to be. And now that's where I finally got. I know Vervaeke had put out a video maybe a year ago about, and the title was something that to me immediately seemed absurd, like we need to train the machines to be wise. And I was like, I think that's probably taking it too far, John. You know, they're just machines. But then as I started to think more about this, I got, oh, now I get the point that Vervaeke is trying to get, is that if they are going to be involved in any sort of moral decision making, whose moral matrix is going to be the one that sets the goals, the parameters for that decision-making process? So you specifically worked on, like, how do you make hospitals and emergency rooms more effective, right? In
better,
you know, okay, like, so what is the better?
Exactly.
All right.
And
what were you trying to do, Sam?
I was trying to make them better, and that's the whole question, is that, you know, what do we mean by better?
Yeah.
So like another way that you could solve this triage problem with a machine, or at least attempt to solve this triage problem, yeah, with a machine, is basically you take a, you know, the last 2 years worth of emergency room admissions, and you have like the variables that the registration person collects from you, and then you try and guess buckets 1 through 5, right? Like the machine will assign a probability to each of the 5 buckets, like based off of the historical data and the data I have on this patient, I give a 60% chance that they're in bucket 3, and, you know, et cetera. It would divvy up the probabilities between the other buckets. You pick the bucket with the highest probability and you go with that one. But all that is doing is trying to imitate the past historical data. And so you're trying to use, instead of the humans who have been making the decisions for the past couple years, you're trying to basically mimic that human making decision with math and probability and parameters inside these models that, you know, turn these variables with parameters into the probabilities. And at best, you would have a high degree of accuracy of mimicking the humans in the past. There would probably be, you know, it wouldn't be perfectly accurate. Like maybe it's like 80 or 90% accurate would probably be a pretty good model by these sorts of standards. But even then, it's just mimicking the moral judgment of the past. And so it is only trying to ape the whatever moral decision-making was in the various humans that have been making these sorts of decisions in its training set. And at that point, you would ask, so why wouldn't I just have the humans keep doing it? maybe the humans are a lot more expensive and you could save, I don't know, a few hundred grand a year if you outsource this thing, but you're going to lose accuracy. But so let's imagine a scenario where we train a model and we have like a 90% accuracy of mimicking the triage decisions of human beings in the past. We fire the humans who used to make this decision, and we have the computer do it, and the computer costs $5,000 a year, but the salaries and benefits of the people who used to do it was in the low six figures or something like that. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. We're saving, you know, over $100,000 a year. But here's the thing, is that this decision-making framework probably changes over time. Like I mentioned, the opioid epidemic had a big effect on how emergency departments had to deal with patients who were seemingly coming to just get drug prescriptions. So let's imagine some new thing like COVID, or some new thing like some future drug epidemic, or some new thing like a change in health insurance policy comes, and these machines are only mimicking the decisions from the previous, you know, regime or the previous state of affairs. But now the state of affairs are so different that it's just mimicking the old decision-making framework. And so it's like judgment has degraded because it is not able to mimic what a human would do in this new situation. It's only mimicking a human in the previous situation. It has no ability. My main point with that story is it has no ability to self-correct and improve in the new situation. Whereas humans, after some amount of time, they would recognize new patterns, new states of affairs, maybe get new directives from their superiors and update their decision making. And humans have an ability to adapt in that sort of way. But because the machine doesn't have any goal that it's seeing that if it's achieving or not, its only goal is mimic this data set that I was trained upon. And so it has no continuous way of evaluating the goodness or the badness of its decision making, whereas a human is always trying to do this. Even like a not particularly good employee is still doing this at some level, and a very dutiful employee is always trying to get better and always trying to make the right decisions. So that's another thing that's interesting about these machines. And ChatGPT has a very similar version of this problem, is that because it doesn't have some sort of intrinsic value structure that it is judging itself by and updating its abilities and decision-making framework by, it doesn't have some target that it's aimed at besides mathematically imitate the accuracy from the past. It doesn't have this like dynamic changing ability that humans sort of intrinsically possess. And you could translate this immediately to ChatGPT. ChatGPT, similar to this imaginary machine that's predicting 1, 2, 3, or 5 in the emergency department, ChatGPT, all it does basically, I mean, this is a simplification, but it's a helpful simplification, is it makes a prediction word by word by word by word of, based off of the prompt that you gave it and maybe the context of your recent conversation, what, like, imagine you just drop in, what is Elvis Presley's birthday, into ChatGPT. What's going on is that it is basically consulting its parameters that are shaped by the training data. And like ChatGPT has hundreds of billions of parameters. It's an extremely, extremely complicated statistical model. And it will notice that kind of notice. Again, I'm using these words like notice. It doesn't like notice, but like I'm using these words as metaphors to try and describe its behavior that, oh, in the text that I was trained upon, call it Wikipedia and a whole bunch of the internet and open source books and stuff like that, that in sentences that contained the phrase Elvis and Presley and birthday, you know, the word February, I actually don't know Elvis Presley's birthday. Let's just say it's in February. The word February was a very highly correlated word with the phrase, with the words Elvis and Presley and birthday. So I'm going to go with the first word it'll say is Elvis's. And then it'll be like, all right, okay, now that I have the text, what is Elvis Presley's birthday? Elvis's. Then the next word is probably birthday. Oh, okay. Now that I have, and then it like feeds in what it's already done into its own prediction. Okay. The next word is, okay, feed that back in. Okay. The next word is probably actually February. Great. And you know, whatever. And it writes its sentence word by word by word, where it's like feeding in its previous output as the input to its next prediction. And that's how it does it. It's just like word by word by word predicting based off of an imitation of the text that shaped its parameters. But if I ask it, what is Paul Anleitner's birthday? You might not be in its training set. And so it's like, okay, guys with the name Paul have a slightly higher probability of being born in July, but it's not a very big difference, but I'm going with July because that, you know, so when ChatGPT is hallucinating, quote unquote, they call it, that's kind of what it's doing, is it's just like, it doesn't have a lot of information, but it has some information that it's just kind of predicting a plausible answer to the text. But ChatGPT, you know, it's only trained on the data that it has in it. And so, like, if you keep that training set stale and, you know, we proceed 5 or 10 years into the future, it will become increasingly irrelevant unless it's continually updating its training data and it continually retraining its parameters, because it doesn't have any goal. The only goal that you could kind of say that it has is to imitate the text that it's in, that's in its training set. And it doesn't have any self-corrective feedback. I mean, a little bit, like you give it thumbs up and thumbs down, like the app has that, right. And it is trying to incorporate that. But even then, that's still the human judgment that's giving it you did good or you did bad. And like, it's still unclear to me exactly how they use that in their updating of ChatGPT. So like, humans, when we're trying, like, I just dropped my daughters off at swim class. They're starting swim class. And so I took them to swim class. They're like, a human is trying to intuit, okay, what am I supposed to be doing? I've seen other people swim. Okay, here's what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I'm managing to float. My instructor is going like this. How can I do my best to go like this? A human is always intuiting what its goal is and trying to figure out some path that it can move towards its goal. And maybe you sometimes have to update your goal as you move along, but humans can handle that task seamlessly as well. But these AI machines, they have to be given a goal by a human. They have no ability to decide what their goal should be by themselves. And this goal has to be completely mathematically explicitly defined. Whereas like when my mm-hmm. daughters are learning how to swim, their goal isn't mathematically defined. I don't even know how I would explain how it's defined. It's sort of abstracted in a very, you know, symbolic and embodied kind of way. Whereas an AI machine needs an explicit mathematical thing that it's improving itself on. Like, guess which bucket 1 through 5 this patient fell into. Guess which word mm-hmm. comes next after I've given you this paragraph. Did you get it right? Good. Did you get it wrong? Bad. You know, so like that, those are some of the differences between humans and AI machines. And so you quickly come up, like you were saying, with the Klingons versus the whatever a Spock is. I'm forgetting what a Spock is. You know, there are these Vulcan. Different moral Vulcan, right? There are these different moral frameworks, and AI can only at best try and imitate the behavior of something that is operating within a moral framework that's been condensed into numbers.
Mm-hmm. So you'd have, okay, so to my mind, one thing that stands out, Sam, is like we have different, our human decision-making process has been shaped by, Captain Obvious here, shaped by different factors than what would be the parameters in which a language learning model would be deciding whether or not Elvis was born in February or whenever he was born. Mm-hmm. For us, when I think about, you mentioned, you know, you're teaching your daughter, she's learning how to swim. Right? What are the parameters that are giving her a sense that she's doing a good job or not? What is actually motivating her towards something that she would say, I am reaching the goal, the intended goal that I have in this particular operation? And for humans, we certainly have like, we've got evolutionarily hardwired desire to survive, right? So she's in the water mm-hmm. and it's in the deep end. She wants to stay alive. So there's a good motivator right there.
She wants and then to also please probably her parents.
There you go. Social, right. Social acceptance in a group. And so you've got those factors, which are important, not like foundational. Like that seems to be, to continue to use like machine and computer terminology. That's like, that's in the hardware. Of humans is like, all right, here's some parameters, right? And typically I am going to make decisions that are going to help ensure my survival perhaps increase the chance of me and my progeny, my genetic code being passed on and preserved. I mean, those are things that I think, again, assuming that that is a story that adheres, the patterns adhere to reality in a way that I know some of my listeners aren't as necessarily committed to maybe Darwin and neo-Darwinian findings in the sciences. But so then we also have like cultural evolution as well, right? So we imagine these hypotheticals like a Klingon culture that has developed a different set of norms and expectations by which you would receive social acceptance, gain social status, therefore triggering your, you know, if Klingons have a serotonergic system, triggering your serotonergic system to give you a hit of serotonin or dopamine in your dopaminergic system because you've received social acceptance. The AI doesn't have any of those things, which I can see when, let's take the hospital and the ER and triage example once again, I can see there being strengths and weaknesses. When someone asks, well, why would anybody do have, you walk up essentially to a kiosk and you put in or even just voice into the kiosk your symptoms and what you're, why you come into the emergency room that day, and the AI takes in that information and it goes through its synthetic or at least maybe the word I'm looking for, it's mimicking moral matrix decision process, it doesn't go through the process of whether or not, let's say, the person coming up to the kiosk is, well I'll take a group that has a large population here in the Twin Cities, Somali. So let's say the person, if it was an actual human being at the kiosk, and they've had maybe a really bad incident involving a road rage incident involving a Somali person earlier that week. And they come in and a Somali person is coming in with their child. And part of that human bias is maybe, I am still very upset at a Somali person for potentially threatening my life. And maybe, I'm not saying it's, you know, like dogmatic or some sort of like Ku Klux Klan kind of racism, but there is that, I had a really bad experience with a person that looks like this. And you know what? When I put in that 1 to 5 measure of how important this person's situation is, my bias in this moment, because I'm still upset because someone that looked like this person threatened my survival earlier, I'm giving them a 1 or whatever the lowest grade is. Whereas if you had that same situation happen with the AI, you wouldn't necessarily have those same sorts of,
well, here's biases, the funny thing,
the racial.
So let's imagine you have an employee who is biased against Somalis. And they work pretty often, and so they represent a large amount of your training set from the past year or two. Maybe a quarter of your training set had the decisions made by this particular employee who is biased against Somalis. The imitation machine, because let's imagine that ethnicity is one of the variables that it is able to see, or even something like zip code or address. Right, because I presume that there are probably different areas of Minneapolis that have more or fewer Somalis. Sure. So then the machine will be imitating, trying to predict which bucket these patients got put in. And so it's trying to imitate the person who's biased against Somalis. And so it will be biased against Somalis to some approximation in the same way with 80 or 90 degree percent accuracy. So whatever biases are in the human training set, the AI machine will be mimicking. So it's not like it is, it's not like it's this rational Spock character who has managed to mathematically abstract away human unfairness. If it's being trained to imitate unfair humans, it will do its best to be unfair in the exact same ways to the extent that it's able.
Okay, so the way this functionally works is that would actually be, you're saying they're just getting the information from past precedent. Is there a final like editorial review or decision maker? How would this actually functionally work, Sam? I know you maybe haven't worked on a specific project that's exactly like this, but you've worked on projects that, right, we're trying to evaluate how do you predict when an emergency room will be most busy, you know. In the end, who would be like the decision maker in a, we'll stick with the hospital system for figuring out if we're going to implement, we're going to replace at a very basic level, we're going to replace the front receptionist or nurse who's at the front with a kiosk that has this AI program, and the AI program is doing the evaluations of who's supposed to be seen first. So you're taking that past precedent, historical precedent, and that's what the language model is learning from. But in the end, is there any like evaluation process of the final product, and who would be like the kinds of people that would be consulted? Like, in my mind, it would seem like, all right, if you're going to do this, you should probably at the end go and be like, all right, we're going to run these through some tests, and but we're also going to have evaluating the outcomes of this, like a moral philosopher, a pastor, a rabbi. This sounds like the beginning of a really bad punchline. who would get the final say? Is it just the CEO at the top? And then you're consulting like their moral matrix. To me, that seems like you'd have to have some sort of final decision maker. Who is it in reality? And who would you say, having kind of like worked in the field, would be like, all right, if we were to do this, this is how I would do it.
I think that this is touching something really deep in our culture right now, is that we often think, sort of Sam Harris being an extreme example, that morality is objective, and that if we just had a super high IQ and all of the relevant information, then moral decisions are obvious or something like that. And that really there shouldn't be actually any difference of values so long as we're being objective and smart about it. And what I think that we don't realize is that that just simply isn't true. In my mind, there is almost no connection, as far as I can tell, between, you can make these computers as smart, quote unquote, have huge computing power, have huge numbers of parameters, et cetera, spend as much money as you can imagine on these AI machines, and they won't be 1 centimeter closer to being moral than a simple one. Because morality is just some completely, other variable or other parameter outside of what it's capable of doing that is just not... I think that our culture is having trouble having a consistent moral story that we all feel like we can agree that we're part of.
Yes.
And that we underestimate how radically different moral systems can be, like Klingons versus Vulcans versus humans and stuff like that. And that it is not rationality itself that can decide between those sorts of moral frameworks of which one is more right or something like that. And that we sort of have this collective Sam Harris syndrome, that it is just IQ and the facts of the matter that will make things better. So like, imagine in this scenario where we've replaced the front desk person with a kiosk, and a patient types in their data, they get given a really low urgency rating, and then the patient dies in the waiting room. It's not unheard. It happens every once in a while that a patient will die in the waiting room of an emergency department. That is I think everyone can agree that was a poor triage decision. If a patient is dying in the emergency room, you did something wrong. Most moral frameworks would agree with that one. So then the family of this patient then decides to sue the hospital for malpractice. Who are they suing? Who is liable for the decision that this machine made? Let's imagine I made it. Is it me? Can they sue the data scientist who maybe has never even been in that emergency department, who works in the IT building across town, who was just typing code on his computer? And then, or is it the IT manager who put this, code that I made into the production system such that it's inside the kiosk? Is it the emergency department at large? Is it the CEO of the hospital? So these are very interesting and complicated decisions. And what I think that we fail to recognize is that we need a moral system that itself is not actually just based off of facts and logic, so to speak. that it is somehow self-standing outside of that framework that we are then doing our best to live up to in the hospital system. And I think we actually used to understand this better than we do now. Almost a surprisingly high percentage of hospitals in the United States were founded by religious organizations. Like, and you can still tell this when you look at the names of hospitals. There, you know, there's Catholic hospitals named after saints. There's like maybe a Swedish Covenant hospital that were often founded by denominations who had decided that they would build a hospital and that it was supposed to be imbued with the moral framework and character of that denomination, because a religion or a branch of Protestantism or whatever was the sort of thing that had this story that could hopefully permeate as best as able down to all the decision making within a hospital. And then a patient would be trusting in that moral story. Maybe if you were a Swedish person, you would be more likely to go to Swedish Covenant. If you were a Jewish person, you might be more likely to go to Mount Sinai or, you know, what have you. And because that was sort of your community and you trusted that moral framework decision. And now we're sort of moving out of that into this sort of weird post-religious, secular, utilitarian kind of riding off of the coattails of the past. But we kind of think we are like more enlightened and rational and fair and unbiased. But like, it's kind of weird and nebulous, and I think that it's showing signs of failing. And I don't mean to be too political, but another thing that's happening in a lot of these hospital systems is what I would call critical theory data science, where there are starting to be, well, like, shouldn't we just triage patients based off of their oppression characteristics or something like that?
Yeah, for sure.
And because it's like trying to compete to be a new moral framework by which things happen. Mm-hmm. And this sort of, you know, post-religious, secular, utilitarian, mushy-gushy thing doesn't have any ability to explain what its purposes are, because it's sort of riding on the coattails of something that used to be able to, but it's disconnected from that thing that used to be able to explain it. And so it's susceptible to this new thing that has very clear moral objectives that it wants. And so I'm starting to see this in hospitals and in the field that I used to be a part of, where it's like, wait a minute, your predictive model is more accurate for Caucasian Americans than it is for the Somali patients. Why is that? Well, the answer is, the training set has more Caucasian patients than Somali patients because Somali patients are a minority. So it has more training data. Right. So it's able to be more accurate for the patients that are more well represented in its training set. That's not like any, it's not the data scientist's fault. It's not the machine's fault. Okay. So we need to bring down the accuracy of the part of the model for Caucasian Americans so that it's equal to Somali patients so that we have equity in our healthcare outcomes. But wait a minute. All that's doing is degrading the performance on one particular group of people so that it's equal to the lower performing group of people. So that if a white patient comes in, the predictive model is now less accurate than it could theoretically be if we let it be as accurate regardless of racial group. And I have seen hospitals that are starting to do this sort of thing. And so that brings up all sorts of moral questions. And I think it's because there is a lack of clear, articulatable moral framework in healthcare, which is representative of our culture at large. And I think that this, like, we're trying to fix the problem with AI or machine learning because we think it's like Sam Harris objective better than us. Like, it's not going to discriminate against the Somalis like we humans do, even though I just explained to you why it could very well just do the same thing. And so I feel like we're in this weird place where we're trying to replace human judgment with machine judgment, but we don't even know what judgment to give the machines because we're losing faith in the stories that used to guide us.
Hey everyone, well, that concludes part one of Can We Teach AI to Be Christian with my friend Sam Tiedemann. If you want to listen to part two, you can go ahead and do that right away. You don't have to wait till next week. You can just become a patron, a supporter at the $7 a month level or higher, and you can watch the full video of this conversation. And so you can go ahead and access that right away if you don't want to wait. Otherwise, come back next week and we'll have part two of Can We Teach AI to Be Christian? This listener-supported podcast is made possible because of the generous support of listeners just like you, and I want to give an extra special thanks to Clint, Brandon, Brent, Daniel, Dave, Eli, Garth, Jean-Marc, Jesse, Jesse P., John-Marc, Josie, J-Tom, Justin, Kate, Lola, Luke, Matthew, Paul, Rob, Sam P., Stephen H., and Tim. Thank you all for your generous support. As always, I love hearing your questions, comments, and feedback. So feel free to reach out to me on Patreon or on Twitter or wherever you might want to find me on social media. And until next time, we'll talk again soon.